Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast where we invite our historians to let off excess steam and light their fourth boiler. The podcast where the unsinkable hubris of myth meets the resolute iceberg of truth. I am your regular host, Paul Bavel, and this week, dear Ragers, we are taking on one of the most mythologised historical events in modern history, the Titanic disaster, and probably not for the last time. To join us on this maiden voyage of doom, we welcome back historian, author of Ship of Dreams, and our guest at one of our Gloucester History Festival specials, Gareth Russell. Gareth, welcome back to History Rage.
Paul, thanks so much for having me.
Excited?
Very excited. I'm intrigued to see how many holes beneath the waterline I can puncture in my argument and anyone else's.
Excellent. Well, since you joined us back in September, where you did an excellent rage about Anne Boleyn is not, and I quote, self-made gal done good. What have you been doing?
Standing by those words, Paul. My most recent book, and when I saw you last time, it had just come out, which is why I was at Gloucester. The Palace from the Children to the Windsors, 500 Years of History at Hampton Court, has come out. We're preparing for the paperback in May. So that's been a large part of it. And I'm currently close to finishing a new manuscript on the private life of James I through six chaps he loved, or as other historians would say, he was just good bros with.
So that's excellent. Excellent. When's that likely to come out?
Early next year.
So we're going to have to get you back on, I think, then to cover James I and all his comings and goings.
With the heavy emphasis on the former. No, I think I think contractually by then, Paul, I should just let you know that I will have to do it in a rough. A large Elizabethan rough, 3 to 4 times the size of my head, I think, will be the only way I could do that one.
In that case, I'm going to launch video podcasting when that happens.
As I get stuck in the door coming through.
Indeed. So before we dive into today's race, then, I've got to ask, and I know you kind of hinted at this when we were in Gloucester, but I've got to ask, I know you for Tudor and, all of that stuff, and edging here into Stuart and stuff like that. How the hell do you come to do the Titanic?
A good Belfast boy will always find his way there, and it is actually quite seriously because of my great-grandparents, who my book, Titanic, The Ship of Dreams, is dedicated to. Thomas and Elizabeth were born in Edwardian Belfast. So Thomas's father, my great-great-grandfather, was one of the shipyard workers at Harlingen Wolff, who worked on the Titanic. And Elizabeth came from a very different background. She came from a more wealthy background. And so my papa's memories of the Titanic, he was still alive when I was born. He died when I was 10 and she died when I was 11. His memories of the Titanic were that of what it looked like to be in East Belfast building it. And the pride and then the grief that a lot of men like his father felt. It's building and then it's sinking. And Elizabeth's version of it was that she could remember seeing it pristine, sailing up Belfast Lock, past picnics from middle-class families viewing it. And maybe that, I think, was the first time I realized that history is so much a matter of perception. Mm-hmm. I grew up in stories of the Titanic. And like many, many schoolboys, I went through an obligatory Titanic obsession. I know. And of course, the ancient Egyptian one. Those are the two, I think, that are a rite of passage almost.
Yes. Once you've graduated from dinosaurs, that's where you go, isn't it?
Absolutely. Dinosaurs or trains are your early ones. And then you have a choice. You can pick Titanic, Vikings, or ancient Egypt, I think, are the three.
Yeah, I definitely went the ancient Egypt route.
Oh, to this day, I don't really believe in reincarnation, but sometimes I think I could have been at least a high priest in ancient Egypt. At least.
yeah, coming back to unleash a terrible curse. No doubt. Yeah,
like a very petty Imhotep. Yeah, absolutely.
So let's get on to this disaster then, because we're here to discuss one of the many myths and misconceptions about the Titanic disaster.
Yeah.
So it would be remiss of me to ask you what is the one thing that you wish everybody would stop believing, because you have answered that already. So question number two then, what's pissing you off today?
Well, do you know, it's since we talked about it, there is an embarrassment of riches in the buffet of things on the Titanic that will just piss you off. But this particular one is the belief, the widespread belief, that the third class passengers were deliberately locked below to prevent them having a chance to escape in the lifeboats. And that there was, and it's immortalized in many movies, most memorably Cameron's one, where you see them being beaten back with the blunt end of axes and miniature pistols being brought in to keep order and pushing the families back in. And then, of course, these horrible moments where the fictional characters of Jack and Rose, but also the passengers depicted by the actors, are being pushed up against these locked grills and these locked metal doorways as the ship is flooding. And it is mercifully bullshit.
Yes, yes. And we will no doubt talk about the particular portrayals within movies as well. I'll tell you the thing that's always got me as well. And this, given your nationality, might ring true with you as well, is like, they're always plucky and bloody Irish, aren't they?
Yeah, they're always, I mean, it's like the Irish immigrants weren't on board as your traveling entertainers. There's always a disproportionate focus on the Irish. There's never a focus on the English immigrants or the French or the Germans, the Russians. There's a kind of very patronizing fetishization of the Irish immigrants, and that they are just there to say, oh, begorra, lucky charms, and play their music for you, which is, you know, look. Yeah.
I mean, if you look at that scene where there's the supposed party stroke Irish hoedown where they're all sat on barrels.
Yeah, that happens in there.
And in there, you've got quite a lot of people wearing kind of farm clothing. You've got people drumming away with barans. She has a pint of freaking Guinness in the middle of it. I mean, can you get any more stereotype trope?
No. And also, you know, anyone who is Irish, not to play one stereotype off with another, but like, Guinness doesn't travel.
Yeah.
It doesn't travel well. If you are worth your salt, the minute that ship's about 20 miles outside of Queenstown, you switch to tea. Yeah, it's also just the whole thing. And I think this bleeds a little bit into how the third class experience is taught or perceived, is that scene to me is this kind of just like rich girl, rich person tourism.
Yeah.
And there is also an irony. You have Rose de Whippicater, who is, I mean, I would rather go to second base with Lord Voldemort than I would even have a brief conversation with Rose from Titanic. I just think she is genuinely one of the most irritating figures in fiction. Yeah, I've got no education, but being working class is so easy. I'll hop off this boat and make a success of it. You'll be dead by the time you reach midtown. So anyway, it also within this movie is kind of having poverty porn, and it's celebrating the idea of the plucky poor people, and it really leaves out the complexity and the reality of the immigrant experience. And part of what the Titanic, and this sort of leads us into this point, when the Titanic becomes a morality play, you need to have poor people for the idea that it's the hierarchy at sea. Mm. And the third class fulfill that role. And I would argue that they probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
And the reason why they shouldn't is because poor people, unfortunately, well, fortunately in this case, could not afford tickets on the Titanic, even in third class. So on average, the tickets on the Titanic for third class cost as much as second class on most other ships. You shouldn't even really call the Titanic third class steerage, because it didn't have dormitory accommodation. If you're going to look at a genuine hierarchical view of Edwardian society, then you should be looking at the stokers. You should be looking at the men in the boiler room. And, you know, Julie Cook's written a brilliant book on this, Titanic and the City of Widows, and what the sinking did to working class communities in Southampton, where a lot of the men who worked in the boiler rooms were from, mm-hmm. and what it did to their families when they died. So the closest comparison I can make to the way you should see third class passengers on the Titanic is, it's kind of economy on like British Airways or Aer Lingus or Delta or Virgin. It's not, you have to have a certain amount of disposable income to be in third class on the Titanic. And so actually that sort of is the start of it, which is that we need, the third class needs to stop fulfilling a role where it's a stand-in for a story we've decided to tell rather than the story the Titanic actually tells.
Yeah, because as I recall from where I looked into it, I think there's quite like a famous steerage family there. I think it's the Goodmans. It's like, I totaled up. He paid something like about £35 for his family's ticket there, which in 1912 is, hate to sound like that, you know, old guy, but that was a lot of money back then. It was a bloody lot of money back then. Yeah. It's more than he earned in a week.
Yeah, you had, look, you had, oh, it's huge. It's a substantial amount of money. The White Star Line also had a really interesting, quite clever policy with its dining saloon in third class, which is that you would get the menu printed on one side along with an illustration off the ship, and you could write it as a postcard at the back with free postage. So essentially what families would do is they would post back, look how big and delicious the ship is.
Yeah.
It was publicity for the company. And they had, when I did Ship of Dreams, I focused on six first class passengers, but I sort of went down the rabbit hole of looking at all of it. And one of the things that I found very interesting was the rules that they had in place that they passed out to third class passengers to say, if there is any instance of a member of the crew speaking to you in a way that you perceive to be disrespectful, this is who you contact to lodge a complaint. You know, it was very, very much, they marketed their third class very openly, and this is a direct quote, for a better class of immigrant, or emigrant, sorry, I suppose if you're leaving, emigrant.
Yeah.
And they marketed it as safe, stable, and the food was a big part of it as well. So, and the safety bit of it is something that I think we can come back to, because it leads into where this myth of the locked doors come from. So one of the things that the layout of the ship, again, is slightly different to what people often expect. First class wasn't at the top, with second in the middle and third at the bottom. First and second sort of ran down next to each other in the middle of the ship, because that's the most stable bit.
Mm-hmm.
Third class was at the back and at the front. And in the bow was where they put cabins for single male travelers. And then the public spaces and cabins for single female travelers and families were at the stern end of the ship. And there were very, very long corridors that linked the two. And at nighttime, doors, those metal grills that you see in the movie, they would have been put in place and locked between those two sets of cabins.
Mm-hmm.
And the White Star Line specifically marketed that to, you know, people with families and also single women, either single in marital status or women who were traveling out to join their husbands who had already emigrated to America and made up enough money for the family to come over, which was a pretty common occurrence at the time. So these doors, these gates were used as a marketing strategy to say, you as a woman will be safe from sexual harassment when you travel with White Star Line. There will be no chance of single men getting to your cabin or bothering you after dinner. And so that is, we'll come back to it, but that is the architectural feature that you later see as the locked gates.
Yeah. As I understand it as well, the third class, because like you say, we can't call them steerage, but third class is pretty much the cornerstone of White Star's business model at that point, isn't it? They actually make more money on that trip from third class than they do from second.
Definitely. So that's a really interesting point. If you'd said first, I would have pushed back, because I think that's a common misconception. Second, you're absolutely right. So what we're seeing in the design of ships at this period, and in particular, if you look at the Titanic and her sister, the Olympic, there's a really interesting development, which is that the Olympic is for the first time pushes its first class accommodation to accommodate more than 1,000 first class passengers. The Titanic is just under 1,000. Both of them have just a few, about 1,100 in third class, but they only have just over 500 in second. And yeah, second class, they're not making a huge amount of money at this point. They're making pretty tidy, substantial profits from first class. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be growing because you are seeing the first real wave of the upper classes traveling for pleasure and doing so regularly. It's no longer a massive thing to go to Europe if you're a member, say, of the American upper class, or to go to America if you're a member of the European upper classes. You can do it in a week. Third class, yes, is the bread and butter. They do make it. Now, that will all change after the First World War, when second class will become a much, much bigger part because the immigration laws tighten up in America. And what the upper classes have been doing before the war, the middle class are doing after. They're traveling more. So second class is sort of not the dud class. That's an unfair way to put it. But it really just about earns its keep. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. It's first and particularly third that is churning out the money.
Okay, so let's get into, let's start with the myth of the locked gates and then spread the third class myths further out. And James Cameron, if you're listening, probably going to rip your movie apart. There you go. I do have a little defense for it that I will bring in later on, but.
Look, one of the big defenses I have of it is that it is one of the most extraordinarily accurate sets ever made, and the attention to detail of what the Titanic looked like and the costumes, everything. It's a visual feast, and you can really see that James Cameron fell in love with the ship. I just, for me, some parts of the storyline, everyone's different, audience-wise. So, where does this story start? Well, interestingly, it really only has two sources, which is kind of mind-blowing when you think of something that has this scope or impact in popular culture. So there are two third-class survivors mm-hmm. who are commonly identified as the origin points of the myth that the third class were locked below during the evacuation of the Titanic. The first one is a young Anglo-Irish farmer called Daniel Buckley, who is invited to give testimony at the American inquiry into the Titanic disaster. And the second is another third-class survivor. He was a Norwegian farmer called Olas Jørgensen Abelseth. And if you look at their testimonies, it's very interesting what they say. Daniel Buckley did not tell the American inquiry that there were multiple locked gates. He mentions one mm-hmm. that they had to ask the stewards to open, and that the stewards got a bit shitty with them about asking them to do it. And that there were low gates that you could step over, but that he thought they should have been open because it discouraged people from opening. And they were between the promenade decks. So at no point, and actually Buckley, and I'll come back to this, Buckley then makes a statement that is, I think, is going too far the other direction. Buckley says, I was in third class and I can tell you we had as good a chance of survival as any of the rest of them did, which we'll talk about in a minute, but that mm-hmm. is not true, but not for the reasons that the people think. The second source, Olas Jørgensen Abelseth, is really interesting. So Abelseth was traveling in one of those cabins that I mentioned for single men. He was traveling in cabin G63, quite close to the point of impact. But his sister, Karen, was traveling at the opposite end of the ship, also in third class, in the cabins for single women.
Yep.
And because Olas was near the point of impact, he felt it very strongly. And far from stewards discouraging them, the third class stewards ran down the corridor, waking up anyone who was confused and saying, you need to get dressed and get up atop as quick as you can. So Olas leaves G63 and heads down the long corridor to try to get to his sister Karen's cabin. And he finds these doors locked, these metal gates locked. He is in a bit of a panic, and he eventually gets a steward to open them so he can get through to Karen. And we know that happens because him and Karen survive it together. And one of the things that we have, and we're really lucky we have, is a letter that Olas wrote in the immediate aftermath. And we're talking 2 days afterwards, that he wrote home to their father in Norway, in which he describes the experience of escaping the Titanic. And at no point does he mention them being forced below and the gates being kept locked, he tells the story I've just told you. Abulseth Olesyan then arrives in America, where a movie producer called Jules Brulator is looking to make a quick buck. Now, he will later make the first movie about the Titanic, but he also makes a sort of animated newsreel of it. He splices together footage of the Titanic Sister Olympic, some of the late Captain Smith in the Olympic's deck, and he tries to hire various Titanic survivors to lend credibility to his commercial endeavor. He's quite lucky in that he's having a very long-standing affair with one of the survivors, a first-class passenger called Dorothy Gibson, who agrees to play a very flattering version of herself in his fictional movie, Saved from the Titanic. But he hires Olas to go into some of the cinemas and narrate the movie and do Q&As with the audiences afterwards. And it's in these sessions that he starts to tell more and more dramatic versions of the sinking, including, oh, the gates were used to trap us below.
Right.
So that is where it really starts, and it gathers momentum. And, you know, obviously there's a bit of me that's like, but I do also understand this is a guy who's caught, you know, who has lost a lot, you know, a lot of third-class passengers were wealthier than most people emigrating to America, but like many people moving at that time, they brought most of their possessions with them.
Yeah.
And most of them did not have insurance. Some of them did, but the vast majority didn't, and Olas didn't. So you also have to take in mind this is someone who did need to earn a crust, who needed to earn a living when he disembarked in America. So you can't judge him too harshly for it. But the work he did for Jules Brulator seems to be patient zero for where this story starts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, we're on the subject of gates as well then. I was kind of being led to believe as well that although you've got the gates that are separating male and female down in the third class, there's quite a lot of route restrictions. The way we see that classic like bit of the movie where like right. Jack gets out onto the first class promenade deck. I sat there in the movie and thought, you have just broken 50 immigration laws, haven't you?
Yeah, he has. So that's a really good point. So one of the reasons why the third class, and so I'll give you some of the survival statistics here. The reason why I said Buckley was wrong when he said us in third class had exactly the same chance as anyone else is clearly not borne out by the statistics. So only 25.3% of passengers in third class survive compared to just over 40 in second and just over 60 in third. So it does, there is a clear difference. That being said, the demographic group hit the hardest was second class men with only 8% survival rate compared to 16 in third, which is still very low, but it's double second. And that has led some historians to make a very good point and say you're leaving out gender. You're just leaving out. Actually, of all three classes, second class had the clearest route to the lifeboats. They had basically one staircase that went straight up and it opened out onto the boat deck. Whereas if you read a lot of first-class survival memoirs, they talk about periods of deep confusion where they were put into the lounge and then told to go out on deck, but the deck outside the lounge was an enclosed promenade. It wasn't actually where the boats were. And then they went back in and they weren't sure. There's almost this sort of the multiplicity of avenues and promenades and deck space the first-class have leads to a lot of confusion about where to go during the evacuation. Second-class had a much clearer route just straight up to the lifeboats. And so, yes, there is definitely an argument to be made that gender played as much, if not as, at least as much a role as class did in the survival statistics.
Yeah, suppose if you're going to get up there as well, and the rule is women and children first, is the most clearest example of like gender causing some of those issues.
Very much so. And then you also have the fact that there are more single men in third class than there are in the others. You know, there are elements of this.
Well, I understand White Star's business model is the idea. What they're targeting is bloke goes to America to start new living. And then once he's built up new living, then sends across for family to come. Yeah. So you're going to be single guy heavy.
All of them are. All, you know, generally speaking, men will outnumber women in third class by quite a considerable. And really, at this stage, it's still quite, you know, the survivor from second class called Kate Buss, and she was traveling on her own to go to meet her fiance, kind of, you know, what you've been talking about. And her kind of says, you know, how often it was mentioned that she was a woman traveling on her own, that this was unusual. It's slightly less unusual among the elite, but it's still not common. So yeah, but very much so in third class, that attitude is magnified and there are more blokes traveling on their own. But the physical layout of third class is deliberately designed to discourage in stable times interactions between the classes in a way, by the way, that they do not try with first and second class. Their promenade spaces are next to each other, separated by a very low fence, which gives you an idea that Edwardian attitudes to class were often self-policing. You just trusted people not to walk over the fence because you could swing a leg up and you're over it. In third class, the reason why, and you said immigration laws, the reason why third class are actually built with warrens away from the other two classes is that at a very popular port embarkation point in Hamburg 20 years earlier, there had been a massive cholera epidemic. And some of the German shipping lines would have what they would call like immigrant villages, where part of your ticket to travel on the ship would be if you arrived early, you would stay in sort of a constructed village and that was near the port for you and your family to sort of, you know, rest a bit after what could be a very long journey. Say you were coming from Russia or somewhere like that. But in one of those villages, a cholera epidemic had happened. And in response to that, the American government had introduced very stringent immigration laws. So if there was any contact between those traveling in the lowest class of travel on a ship and those traveling in the highest, they would all have to be processed through Ellis Island. And obviously for a first and second class passenger, part of what you're paying for, as it is with business class today, is that you get an ease, not just a more comfortable ride, but the difficult bits are smoothed out for you. The queues are shortened. Mm-hmm. And so White Star Line has immigration laws and commercial considerations weighing on them when they design this ship. So there is no easy way for a third class passenger to get up onto the promenade and the boat deck where the lifeboats are held. And the fact that this could and should quite easily have been rectified is shown by what White Star then did 2 years later. 2.5 years later, when they brought and launched the Titanic's younger and slightly larger sister ship, the Britannic, when they put lifeboat davits specifically on the third class bit of open air deck space, that could have been done. Now, it makes the ship look a bit unsightly, but, you know, overall, not a major concern.
Yeah.
And certainly not after the Titanic. But in the halcyon days of hubristic optimism before the Titanic sinks, they don't want to clutter the line. So they keep the boats on first and second class, and third class, because there's more of them, are given this sort of uncluttered, self-contained promenade space on the poop deck at the very back of at the stern. So the physical layout of third class is a big part of what goes wrong that night. Because I'm really conscious of never, I don't want to sound like a fucking idiot. But one of the things is I don't want to say is the third class were fine. Daniel Buckley was wrong when he said that. There were three major factors that contributed to why the death toll was higher in third class. Mm-hmm. And as we've said, look, if you were a third class male, you had twice the level of survival chance as a second class male. So it's not all about class. Gender expectations and the evacuation protocol did play a big part in it. But for the three reasons why third class were stuck The first is what we've just talked about, the architectural layouts. So you have a ship that is not designed to make it easy for them to get where they would need to be during an evacuation. Now, obviously, the intention is not that, but that is a result of it.
Yeah.
The second one is, and one thing the camera maybe gets really right, is that it shows the decoration of those third-class corridors. Every hole looks the same.
Yes.
So if you think today about going into a hotel or a cruise ship, it takes you a while to get your bearings. Everything kind of looks the same in the hallways. So that is a big part of the problem. So you would have needed crew who were well-versed and prepped in get these people the fuck up on deck as quickly as you can in order to get these people navigated through, these 700-plus people navigated through the corridors and up to the boat deck. Or across and up to the boat deck, mm-hmm. I should say. And that does not happen. And one of the things I look back on The Ship of Dreams when I wrote it, if I have a regret about it, I think I might have been too lenient on Captain Smith and the way mm-hmm. chivalry sometimes softens a fist. And I look at it and I think, actually, he made some fucking massive errors of judgment. And even that's being too kind. One of the things that he does not do is he makes a conscious decision not to tell people that the ship is in extremis. And he says, and the official reason is that they don't want panic, that they don't want a rush for the lifeboats. But he does find time to walk over to the Countess of Rothes, who was one of the figures I looked at, and say, look, by the way, make sure you're dressed warmly and get in the lifeboat. And okay, the Countess of Rothes is actually a pretty good egg of a person. She's not a panicker. There's a fantastic mm-hmm. vignette of her in the lifeboats with this seaman called Thomas Jones, and the two of them both have a zero capacity for bullshit. So she essentially says, look, I can row, so, you know, put me to good use. And the two of them basically take over the lifeboat and kind of run it together, and they end up having this lifelong friendship, and he refers to her as the plucky little countess. But for all that Captain Smith knew, the Countess of Rothes could have run around and told everyone in first class, by the way, we're screwed, get in the boats. You know, he wasn't so averse to telling people that he didn't leak it to some passengers who then, you know, could easily have started panic. It's simply down to the Countess's personality that she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that none of the what we would call the hospitality staff, the stewards and stewardesses, none of them are told that it's an evacuation to the last extremity. And you have instances in first and second class where Thomas Andrews is kind of having to chase after them and saying, like, put your lifebelt on. The passengers need to see you with it on. Or he's trying to rush passengers into the lifeboats. And that sense of that total lack of urgency happens in all three classes. So there's a really interesting kind of macabre moment in first class where the purser hasn't been told how bad the situation is. So he thinks it's freezing outside. So he reopens the first class lounge. The band comes in and plays. Hot cocoa is being served. And everyone obviously gathers in the lounge.
Yeah.
And you get multiply that a dozenfold in third class. Absolutely none of the staff in charge of third class have been told, get them up on deck. So you don't have a staff who has any sense of urgency about breaking immigration laws. So they're just waiting there. They're until they are told, break everything you've been trained to do and get them up to the first and second class areas of the ship. They're not going to do it.
Yeah.
The layout comes back into this a bit. I mentioned the family cabins, the women's cabins, and the public areas, so the general room, is where the third class would have congregated at this point. They're at the stern of the ship, which is the last bit of it that starts to feel the effect of the sinking. So yeah. You have everything in third class that is encouraging a sense of calm. That then leads into the next bit, which is even more mundane, but the impact is even more disastrous. I did a quick search of nationalities of the three classes.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of them, isn't there?
Yeah, so there. If you go into first class, 9 out of 10 passengers had English as their first or only language. In second class, it's 8 out of 10. In third class, it's 2 out of 3. And if you look at the crew, well over 9 out of 10.
Yeah.
Only speak English. If you look at the signs, every sign is only in English. So even when the crew do start to think, shit, maybe they should be up in the, near the lifeboats just in case, trying to explain that becomes almost impossible for some of them. There are over a dozen languages spoken in third class. So you have a ship that is not designed to get them up there quickly. You have a crew who are not told they need to get them up there quickly. And you have a crew that aren't trained to communicate that they need to get them up there quickly. So you have these three factors that are really banal. They're not kind of, ooh, let's hit third class with, you know, the blunt bit of an axe and point guns at them and lock them below and push them down because they're poor. You have these three really mundane facts that weave together to create a result that is just as tragic, simply because something isn't malevolent doesn't make it correct, doesn't make it any less tragic. And that, I think, is for me probably the lesson to take from the third class disaster in the Titanic. When you make this idea that the stewards, many of whom were also working in middle class, would go down and push back people who were like their own families and close the doors, that you would have Captain Smith, who, look, I'm not a fan, would say, by the way, keep them below. I mean, that is genuine, monstrous evil that you're talking about.
Yeah, and that's the sort of stuff that comes in the 1934 Nazi Titanic, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, which is, you know, evil on celluloid. and that I think, where I get a little bit frustrated is, it has come into the 20th and 21st century as our version of Marie Antoinette saying, let them eat cake. It doesn't matter how many times you say this is horseshit, it has become a myth on which moral lessons are hung. And I think there's something perhaps even more chilling and more thought-provoking about saying it doesn't have to be people locking you in and people wanting to be monsters. It can be the mundane details of everyday life that are not thought through, that carry with it a whiff of snobbery and complacency, that when they weave together, they will have a truly catastrophic impact on innocent families and innocent people. And that, to me, is what I take from the lesson in third class. So I do get irritated with the enduring nature of they were locked below, because I think A, it's wrong, and B, it also obscures really useful lessons that we could take from this, which is that just because you can't envisage a tragedy happening doesn't mean you shouldn't be prepared for it. And sometimes it's the everyday that will fuck you up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always that classic phrase of it's, you know, you're more likely to die of incompetence than conspiracy.
That's it. This is why I'm dubious in conspiracies in general, because I think there's, I'm sort of interested in this idea that we latch onto conspiracies because on the surface they're more appalling, but deep down they're more comforting, because they tell you there's a plot, there's a scheme,
there's a
plan. Sometimes there isn't a fucking reason. Sometimes the world is just horrific and it's in the commonplace that will end your life. And that, to me, is the more genuinely terrifying thing. It's the same with the Titanic in general, where people's, you know, it was the steel, it was the rivets, it was the rudder, it was the coal, it was the fire,
It's never the freaking iceberg, is it?
It was a fucking iceberg. It was big, it was going too fast, it didn't see an iceberg, it hit it, it sunk. I don't know what else you want from me. And I think there is a really interesting psychological thing there of people kind of saying, well, look, if it had been better built, it would have been fine. No, it wouldn't. It was the best built ship it could have been in 1912, but the iceberg was built better.
Yeah.
And if you fling yourself at nature, it's going to win. And so that, I think, that's sometimes why it's Occam's razor with the Titanic. That's what it is. The story doesn't become more interesting the more conspiracies you ladle onto it. It's tragic enough in its ordinariness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this is where I started to get irritated with the Cameron movie. Not on the basis of its various kind of historical howlers or adding to various myths or anything like that, because to defend that, if you look at the way that film is framed, it isn't A Night to Remember. It isn't telling the story of the Titanic disaster. It is, what, let's say, consider the film set in 1996, the year that it's at least made. That would make Rose DeWitt, what, 103? She's 19 when she gets on the Titanic, is she?
They say she's 17, which 17. Is all kinds of problems.
Well, but it yes. was
But
she's, there's the whole Dirty Dancing problem there, isn't there? But so it makes her then like 101. So if you're sitting there listening to the recollections of a 101-year-old woman who was at once a traumatized 17-year-old girl who's being got onto this salvage ship somewhere out in the North Atlantic where all that shit happened to talk about her ridiculous necklace.
Yeah.
You're not telling me, it's like why I never look at 300 and think, well, this is a bit shit recounting of Thermopylae. That's not it. It's, you know, it's one guy telling a campfire story. And so I can kind of cope with it on that point, you know, but yeah. I watch it and I came out of the cinema at the end of it and I just thought, is the Titanic disaster not dramatic enough that you need to put all this shit in there?
Well, yeah, the other thing I would say, just to my point about Rose being a monster, which no one ever gives me credit for, 2 points. She is still a vapid, spoiled, rich little princess. What level of self-absorbed do you have to be like, you know, this £300 million necklace? I'm going to drop it into the ocean to my dead one-night stand's fishy aquatic ghost, rather than hand it to a museum where plenty of people could see it, or I don't know, sell it for charity. No, fuck it. Me and Jack are still the center of the universe. You're 48 years old at this stage, Rose. Surely you have learned through two world wars, the Great Depression, and having to restart your life in Edwardian New York, that maybe you could have done something better with this than fuck the heart of the ocean into the sea to make a dramatic point like a teenager on a Tumblr profile. And the other thing is, no one ever really holds her to account for the level of selfish she was when she wanted to get down to see Jack when he was locked up during the sinking of the Titanic. And rather than take the fucking stairs, she pushed a worker into an elevator and was like, take me down, damn it. No, Rose, this man is perfectly entitled not to want to take you down into the bowels of a flooding ship. It's beyond his pay grade, you entitled mess. And that is why I hate Rose DeWitt Buchanan. It's one of the...
Do you feel better for that?
I really do. I feel like when people talk about it being a great love story, I'm like, is it? Or is it the unbearably banal whingings of the world's most entitled brat? Just
Well, you mentioned there about, you know, the worker's got absolutely every right to go do one, Missy. I'm getting it.
But Holly, let me say to you, I'm off the clock.
The union's going to have something to say about this. But what do we know of actually what the White Star staff did? In terms of, you know, do we have any particular stories? I mean, I understand that one ended up drowning just because he kept going back down there to kind of ferry more people out. But yeah, what do we know of the stewards and the third class staff at the disaster?
We know frustratingly little, Paul, partly because we think most of them drowned. We do know a lot, sorry, going back to get that. We do know, I mean, there's at least one, so we can assume there were more. If that makes sense. I mean, that's a tentative assumption, I should say. We do know that this isn't crew, but this is really interesting because it gives us an idea there has to at some point have been quite easily signposted or accessible routes back to third class, or at the very least, crew members who would take them back. So there were two priests, Catholic priests, traveling in second class, and Father Perishitz and Biles, I think are the names. If I'm wrong, I apologize. But one was German, one was English, and they had celebrated mass. It was Sunday, remember, the day it hit the iceberg. They had celebrated mass earlier in the day, once in the second class library and then again in the third class general room. So they had been among third class earlier, and they had sort of wrangled that they could be allowed to go in and not break the immigration laws because they would sort of be forward during the celebration of the mass. But what... They did go back. They asked to be taken back into third class to sort of offer comfort and help get people up on deck. So there is definitely, and now both of them, I should point out, drowned as well. They actually are quite movingly seen on the deck leading a recitation of the Rosary with survivors from all classes of travel sort of around them during the final plunge. But the departure of the two priests back to third class and then them getting back up on deck for that moment with the Rosary would indicate that there was quite a bit at some point in the evacuation of travel back and forth between third class. I would argue that's probably at the point at which the crew feel the tilt, because they certainly don't seem to have been told by Smith. So I think it's when the crew put two and two together and mm-hmm. then they try to ferry them up. But the fact that, as she mentioned, there's a crew member who goes back and drowns, and we can take a reasonable guess there were others, would indicate that they are having difficulty getting, as we mentioned, because of the language difficulties, getting a lot of people up.
Yeah. And I'll round off with a last question, because you mentioned it at the start there, and I do think it's a really interesting point, which is if you want to look at the actual working classes of Edwardian England yeah. on the Titanic, you want to be looking at the Stokers.
Totally.
And we never get, none of the movies will do anything about the Stokers other than the bit in the camera movie goes, right, lads, you've done your bit, get out before the lights go out.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, what are the Stokers doing? What is their fate? How much of that do they know?
Well, the Stokers are at, I mean, point of impact. Some of them are in point of impact. They see the ship buckle. They see the water coming after the iceberg hits it. I mean, there are interesting testimonies from a couple of first-class passengers, actually, a couple of American first-class passengers, when they mention quite early on seeing the Stokers come up, a few of the Stokers come up on deck. And that to them is that they see them covered in soot. And that to them is the first thing where they think, shit, something is seriously wrong here. But bro, I mean, I mentioned Julie Cook's book, Titanic and the City of Widows, because she is the great-granddaughter of one of the Stokers who drowned on it. And talking about, I mean, how heavily hit they were in terms of casualties. They were decimated as a section of the crew. But even just how, you know, the shifts that they did, how long they were, how exhausting. And really, you have to wonder, and this is speculation on my part, but they didn't come up. They stayed in their areas of accommodation. They were fed, you know, used the loo or whatever, slept, went back and ad nauseum until you reached New York and then you came back. And you have to imagine that if you've been down underground, you know, for 4.5 days next to furnaces that you leave to sleep, you're covered in coal dust. Going up into the Atlantic cold air, any kind of cold air, must be pretty discombobulating. And they are dressed, you know, we've accounts of sort of colliery disasters on land, where they say they'll find a lot of the miners who died, say in the Haswell colliery explosion, they will find them almost naked, because a lot of the men who were working down the mines, they worked almost half naked because it was so, or close to naked because it was so hot. There was what the Stokers would have been wearing would have been too dissimilar. You would have had some kind of obviously clothes on because you didn't want to get burnt, but you still dressed really lightly. So the chances are, the minute they got up, they were discombobulated from the air, and the exposure would have killed them quicker than it would have killed a lot of other people.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you very much for that, then.
My pleasure.
Would you like to give then the closing remarks? You know, what do you want people to take away from this? What would you like people to think about what we've discussed tonight?
Well, it's a tough one, but a good one. I think take away from this that identifying the correct causes of a tragedy is never an attempt to lessen the impact or scale of that tragedy. And also to remember that the Titanic is a jarring and monumental lesson to how ordinary, commonplace decisions can lead to extraordinarily tragic results.
Well, thank you very much. Do you feel better having got your roast DeWitt Bacata system out of your system?
Mistaken. I also hate Jack, but he can wait for another one. Yeah, Rose, I think. Stand by that Lord Voldemort. point. Yeah, I have to say
on Jack, the moment he turns up on that deck there and thinking, well, there's no point saving him because if he gets to New York, he's just going to get quarantined and deported anyway, isn't he?
Absolutely. And like, do you want to see my sketches? You're just the most irritating. No, by the way, Jack, just as a heads up, no one will ever want to see your sketches. And when you say I had a love affair only with her hands, that's gross. Sure. So yeah, anyway, the two of them I could have done without, but I actually do think the movie is an extraordinary piece of cinema. I do think when you look at it, it's hard to take your eyes off it. It's monumental.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for that, Gareth. Thank you. Paul. I know you've been building up to getting that off your chest. At time of release, you're going to be coming back to us probably about 3 to 4 months away take on the perception of Catherine Howard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right then. So we will wait with bated breath for that one. And everybody out there, do please tune into that one. Well, if you'd like to know more about the subject, then we are going to have links to Gareth's book, Ship of Dreams, in the History Rage bookshop. You'll be able to see and hear him speak at many Tudor and literary festivals covering both the palace, and then we will get you back on next year to cover James II. I won't say cover James II, but James II. Sure. Start again. We'll get you back on to cover James I in a manner of speaking. But once again, thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul. I appreciate it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I'd really appreciate any reviews you could leave with Apple, Podchaser, Amazon, or any review system that you can connect to. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at History Rage, or me individually, I am at Paul Bavel. And if you're loving this, then please support The Rage on Patreon, because in return for your cherished £5 per month, you will get early episodes, entry into all of the prize draws, the invite to put questions to future guests, and of course, the coveted History Rage mug. And you can subscribe at patreon.com/History Rage. But until next week, from everyone here, stay angry. Bye-bye.